This podcast contains graphic content and crimes against children that may not be suitable for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. I want to remind our listeners you can view all episodes and transcripts, purchase merchandise, and support our show by visiting our website. Your support is what keeps this show going, and any and all support is greatly appreciated. Over the past few decades, advances in DNA testing technology have revolutionized the field of forensic science, providing investigators with a powerful tool to solve crime cases. With the ability to analyze even the smallest samples of DNA, such as a single strand of hair or a drop of blood, forensic scientists can now identify suspects with a high degree of accuracy. Criminals who once thought they had successfully committed murder or other serious crimes are now finding themselves being forced to answer for their heinous actions. As a result, law enforcement agencies around the world are increasingly relying on DNA evidence to solve crimes and bring criminals to justice. Gary Eastburn, a captain in the U.S. Air Force, met Catherine Katie Furnish in the 1970s, and they married in 1975 when Katie was 22 and Gary was 26. The Eastburns would go on to have three girls, Kara in 1979, Aaron in 1981, and Jana in 1983. In the same year Jana was born, they moved to Fayetteville, North Carolina, where Gary served as an air traffic control chief at Pope Air Force Base in Pope Field, North Carolina. Just 2 years later, Gary had to undergo training at a squadron officer school where he had to live temporarily in Montgomery, Alabama, 500 miles apart from his wife and children. The family didn't have plans on staying in Fayetteville for long, as their plan was to move to England so Gary could take up a job as a liaison with the Royal Air Force. In preparation for the move, Katie began to pack up the things in the house and take care of what she could while Gary was away in training. The two agreed to keep an ongoing schedule to talk to each other on the phone every Saturday morning. Moving to a different state was nerve-wracking and stressful enough, but moving to another country presented an entirely different set of challenges. The Eastburns knew they would have to leave their friends and family behind, but due to strict military regulations, they also weren't allowed to take any pets with them. Katie knew her girls would be heartbroken, but she also knew she had to make arrangements to find a new home for the family's English setter, Dixie. On Tuesday, May 7, 1985, she posted an ad for the dog in a local newspaper called the Beeline Grab Brag. It was around 9 p.m. that same day when someone responded to the ad. 27-year-old U.S. Army Sergeant Timothy Hennis called the number on the ad and spoke to Katie, arranging a time to come and visit the dog at their home. Hennis and his wife Angela had recently become parents that year, but their dog Snowball was jealous of their newborn daughter Christina, so they were on the lookout for a new dog that was used to being around children. When Tim Hennis arrived at the Eastburn home on May 7th, he and Katie chatted for a while. Then, before leaving with the dog, he asked Katie if he can use the restroom. Trusting a fellow soldier, she of course said yes. After he was done, Hennis leashed up Dixie and took her home. When Saturday, May 11th rolled around, the payphone outside of Gary Eastburn's dorm room didn't ring at the usual time of 8 a.m., the time that Katie was supposed to call. Back in the 80s, there were no cell phones or pagers or anything that you can contact anyone with other than the standard landline phone. Gary tried to call Katie, but the phone just rang and rang, and she never picked up. He figured she was probably busy or running errands with the kids and would call him when she had some extra time in her day. As a precaution, he called the local sheriff's department and asked them to drop by the house to leave a note on the door asking Katie to call her husband. On Mother's Day, May 12th, the Eastburns' neighbors, Army Sergeant Bob Seafelt and his wife Jeanette, had noticed the daily delivered newspapers piling up at the Eastburn house. The Eastburns' car was in the driveway, and their baby stroller was parked in its usual place by the side door. It was unusual for their neighbor not to retrieve the papers each day, and they realized they hadn't seen the family in several days. Bob decided that he'd pop over there and check on them to make sure everything was okay. He went up to the front door, picked up the Sunday paper dated May 12, 1985, tossed it aside with the others in the driveway, and knocked on the door. No answer. He then rang the doorbell a few times. Still no answer. From inside the home, he could hear the Eastburns' baby crying. There's no way Katie would have left the baby alone in the house. He called Jeanette over to see if she could hear the baby, and he rang the doorbell again. Jeanette got her phone book and looked for the number to the Eastburns' babysitter, Julie Cerniak, who lived just a few houses down the street. When Julie picked up, Jeanette frantically told her, "Julie, I think something terrible has happened." Julie gave her the Eastburns' phone number, but when Jeanette called, it just rang. No one picked up. "Please let her answer," Jeanette said. She let it continue to ring, but still no answer. Jeanette then called the Cumberland County Sheriff's Department. At 12:53 a.m., the dispatcher called for an officer to go on scene to attend to a child neglect call. Before police arrived at the house, Julie drove up. She walked up to the house and peeked inside a window. She gasped, telling Bob and Jeanette, "Jana's standing there in her crib." Julie ran to the back of the house, searching for a way in. Maybe the back door was open, or maybe she could pry open a window. But Bob yelled to her and told her they should probably wait for police. "Don't touch anything," he yelled at her. "Just go on," Julie yelled back. "I want to get in and find out." Officer William Toman was the first to arrive at the Eastburn home on 367 Summer Hill Road. Toman tried the front door of the house, the back door, and the windows. They were all locked. No one had forced their way into the home. He found a note jammed inside the front door. It read, "Mrs. Eastburn, get in touch with your husband by phone. Deputy Price." This was the note that Gary Eastburn had instructed the sheriff's department to leave for Katie several days ago. Toman shrugged and rang the doorbell. No answer. By this time, other neighbors began to gather in the streets around the Eastburn home. Toman's sergeant had driven to the house and yelled out his window, "What do you think we should do?" Toman wasn't sure. He then heard a baby crying. He leaned over the porch railing, pressed his nose to the bedroom window, and cupped his hands to his temples to peer inside. There was baby Jana, standing in her crib with her arms outstretched, reaching for anyone. "I've got no choice," Toman told his sergeant. "I've got to go in." He stepped over the railing, cut through the window screen, and lifted the window. He poked his head inside the window and immediately smelled something awful. He knew that smell. It was the smell of death. Jana put her arms up and reached for Toman, and he picked her up. She wrapped both her arms around him and dug her little nails into his neck. "It's all right," he told her. "It'll be all right." Her little blue and yellow flowered pajamas were soaked in urine and feces. She was pale and her eyes were puffy from crying. There were several stuffed animals and toys on the floor immediately next to her crib. It was obvious she'd tossed them from the crib. It was as if someone had placed them in there, knowing she'd be alone for a while. Toman passed the infant to Bob through the window and grabbed a stack of Pampers near the crib, along with a bottle, and told Bob to stand by as he called for backup. It was a warm spring day, and as all the windows in the home had been shut, the smell was almost unbearable. Other officers had arrived at the home and they began searching through the house. In the living room, they saw a pair of jeans, two buttons on the floor, and a pair of torn ladies' underwear. They walked through the home until they came upon a bedroom. There they discovered 5-year-old Kara Eastburn. She was curled up in bed with a Star Wars blanket pulled up over her, and she was covered in blood. Next, they moved to what they discovered was the master bedroom. 3-year-old Aaron Eastburn lay on one side of the bed, and it appeared she'd been bludgeoned severely. And on the other side of the bed lay Katie Eastburn. She'd been stripped down to the waist and had what appeared to be multiple stab wounds. All 3 victims' necks had also been cut. It was evident from the state of the bodies that all 3 had been dead for some time. The only survivor of the home, 22-month-old Jana, was sweaty, severely dehydrated, and was suffering from diarrhea. Doctors would say that Jana had been only about 8 hours from death. As officers secured the scene, the coroner arrived to remove the bodies of Katie and her 2 girls.
Detectives say they found the bodies of Catherine Eastburn and her 2 children. Their throats had been slashed.
It scares me. Terrifies me for them. It really does.
Who would do such a thing? I mean, you cannot look at that crime scene or hear about that crime scene and not just have the word madness come up.
Detective Jack Watts of the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office contacted Gary Eastburn and told him to come home immediately as there had been a death in the family.
And I was in the dorm room and someone said, "Hey, Gary, you got a phone call." I go, "Oh, good, it's her." He said, "Some detective." First thing I said, "How many of them are dead?" He wouldn't tell me anything. He just said there had been a death in the family and that I needed to get home as soon as possible.
Gary arrived in Fayetteville to the devastating news of his wife and daughter's deaths. As investigators questioned him, he frantically told them what he could. He hadn't been at home, but had been living in Alabama for training, and his wife and 3 daughters were at home alone. He told them what had happened over the last several days and the last time he'd spoken to his wife. He racked his brain for any and all details that he could remember, when he recalled that Katie had put an ad in a local paper for someone to adopt their dog Dixie, but he didn't know if anyone had answered the ad or who had picked up the dog. Lead detectives Robert Biddle and Jack Watts combed through the Eastburn home, and forensics retrieved hair, fingerprints, and biological evidence from the crime scene, and luminol was used on the walls and master bathroom of the home. Luminol is a water-based solution that detects blood that has been diluted up to 10,000 times. Once it comes in contact with blood, it reacts by causing the blood to show up as a fluorescent pale blue color. When the walls and bathroom of the Eastburn home were sprayed with the solution, it indicated that somebody had tried to clean up the crime scene. Investigators also discovered bloody footprints outside of the home that matched a size 9 shoe. Gary walked through the house with the detectives, identifying anything out of the ordinary or any missing items. He noticed Katie's ATM card, a piece of paper that had her ATM password written on it, and an envelope that contained $300 in cash were all missing from the house. The first night detectives were on scene, a janitor named Patrick Cohn walked up to Biddle and Watts and told them about an incident he recalled in the early morning hours of May 10th. He said, quote, "I was walking home from my girlfriend's house at 3:30 a.m. As I was walking, I saw a white Chevette parked on the road. Then I saw this white dude walking down the lady's driveway. I passed right by him and he said, 'I'm getting an early start this morning,' or something like that. Then I watched him get in his white Chevette and drive off." Patrick Cohn gave very specific details about that encounter, telling them that the man was tall, about 6'4", had blonde hair that peeked out from a knit cap, had a wide nose and mustache, and that he was wearing blue jeans, a white shirt, and a black members-only jacket, and that he was carrying a garbage bag. Investigators had Patrick meet with the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation to produce a composite sketch of the suspect. Child psychologist Helen Brantley was brought in to question little Jana to see if she could extract any information from the child. Jana was shown a picture of her mother to stir her memory, and the child leaned over and kissed the picture. Jana told Brantley that she was told to, quote, be quiet and to hide from the burglar, that he's going to come get me. The psychologist theorized that Jana's sisters had told her to stay hidden from the perpetrator. An autopsy was conducted on Katie and her two girls. The autopsy would reveal that Katie was stabbed 15 times and that her throat had been cut multiple times. It also revealed that she'd been raped as her body contained the presence of semen. 5-year-old Kara had been stabbed in the chest multiple times and her throat had been cut as well. 3-year-old Aaron had been bludgeoned and beaten in the chest and back, and her throat had been cut as well. Based on the autopsy and witness statements, the medical examiner and investigators estimated that Katie and her two daughters were murdered between 8 p.m. on May 9th and 3 a.m. on May 10th. As the police investigation proceeded, Gary's whereabouts could easily be ascertained, and he was cleared almost immediately as a suspect. 3 days after Katie and her girls were found murdered in their home, police released the composite sketch of the suspect and asked the public for any information about a person who answered an advertisement to pick up a dog from the Eastburns' home.
Earlier today, authorities issued a press release requesting information on an individual who apparently picked up the family pet, Dixie.
While Angela Hennis and her husband, Tim Hennis, were watching the news on TV, they saw a segment about the Eastburn murders and were shocked to see the composite sketch and the request for information about the Eastburn's advertisement for the dog. Realizing that he'd picked up their dog just days earlier, Tim Hennis decided to drive down to the sheriff's station to speak with the detectives about his interaction with the Eastburns and their dog. Timothy Hennis was born in February 1958 and grew up in Rochester, Minnesota. He graduated from Mayo High School in 1976. His father, Robert Hennis, was a manager and worked for IBM Rochester during the 1970s. Hennis worked in Rochester until he joined the U.S. Army in 1980. He then married, and he and his wife Angela had a daughter in 1985. Around May 1985, Hennis worked as a parachute rigger at Fort Bragg. As soon as Detective Watts walked into the interview room where Hennis was waiting, he immediately saw the resemblance to the composite sketch of the suspect. Also of interest was the fact that Hennis drove a white Chevette, the same type of car that Patrick Cohn witnessed seen in the early morning hours of May 10th. Willing to freely speak with investigators without an attorney, and never asking for one, Hennis acknowledged that he had in fact picked up the Eastburns' dog on May 7th, 2 days before the murders had taken place. But he had no other contact with Katie except for a phone call on May 9th, when they talked briefly about how Dixie was doing and how she was settling into her new home. According to Hennis's account of his whereabouts the night Katie and her daughters were murdered, he said he drove his wife and daughter to his in-laws on the night of May 9th and returned home after getting gas for his car. He was asked and readily provided authorities with his blood, saliva, hair samples, and fingerprints. Due to his close resemblance to the composite sketch, the detectives identified Hennis as their prime suspect, but they didn't have enough evidence yet to arrest him. While they were collecting biological evidence from Hennis, they were creating a lineup for Patrick Cohn. They happened to have a mugshot from Hennis in their files from past check bouncing charges. A lineup of 5 photos was placed in front of Patrick, and he positively identified Hennis as the man he saw that morning. By this time, Hennis was now getting suspicious of the questioning and asked detectives if he needed to get a lawyer, with which they replied that it was just a routine interview. After several hours of questioning, they released him and he drove home. Tim and Angela Hennis returned home and thought they'd done everything they could to assist in the investigation. But it wasn't long after they arrived that they received a knock on the door. It was sheriff's deputies, and they were there with a warrant for Tim Hennis's arrest.
Investigators say the arrest of Army Sergeant Timothy Hennis early this morning capped off one of the most intensive murder investigations in Cumberland County history.
During a review of Katie's bank records, detectives were able to determine that Katie's stolen ATM card had been used twice on the night of May 10th and also on the morning of May 11th, with the two transactions amounting to a total of $300. According to a review of Hennis's financials, he was late on his monthly rent payment, and they already knew he had prior convictions for writing bad checks. So they thought to link this with the withdrawals made on Katie's account. In addition, a female witness who visited the ATM shortly after the second transaction on May 11th had witnessed a blonde man wearing camouflage pants matching Hennis's description in the same area near the ATM. When checking into Hennis's alibi, a former girlfriend named Nancy Mazur came forward and told authorities that Hennis had come by her house the night of May 9th unexpectedly. Hennis had left out this piece of information and had told investigators that he went home after dropping off his wife and daughter at his in-laws. Hennis had also brought a black members-only jacket to a dry cleaner on May 10th, and his neighbors recalled seeing him burn items inside of a barrel on the morning of May 11th, stating that he stood there for 5 hours tending to the fire. They'd never seen him burn anything in a barrel before, so this stuck out in their minds as unusual. Hennis's landlord was also interviewed and told police that Hennis was late paying his rent that month. He owed $345, and he'd been able to pay the rent a few days later, only days after the murders. Hennis's fingerprints, his blood, and hair were tested against the evidence found at the crime scene. But remember, it was 1984, and forensics was nowhere near what it is today, and DNA testing was at its infancy. The blood came back as inconclusive, and the fingerprints and hair were not a match and were also inconclusive. As a matter of fact, no evidence in the house could be linked to Tim Hennis. The size 9 footprints found outside of the Eastburn home were 4 sizes smaller than Hennis's feet. He wore a size 13. Hennis's trial began in 1986. His defense team consisted of Fayetteville lawyers Gerald Beaver and Billy Richardson, two of the best criminal defense attorneys in the state. William Van Story IV was the lead prosecutor for the state. Prior to the start of the trial, Hennis was offered a plea deal. 2 counts of second-degree murder with a likely penalty of 2 consecutive life sentences. Hennis refused the offer. During trial, the prosecution's theory was fairly simple: that Hennis went to the Eastburn home looking for sex, that he'd tried to start a romantic relationship with Katie Eastburn, and when she denied his advances, he killed her and her 2 children. As part of their evidence, they presented the witness testimony of Patrick Cohn and the female's eyewitness account from the ATM where Katie's stolen card was used. The state showed the jury several very graphic photos and videos from the crime scene, as well as from the autopsies. The prosecution had no physical evidence that tied Hennis to the crimes, so their case relied heavily on circumstantial evidence. The Eastburn's babysitter, Julie Cerniak, testified that Katie told her she thought she had a stalker. Someone had been prank calling the family for months before the murders, and sometimes the caller would say sexual things to Katie. Julie admitted that her stepbrothers resembled Tim Hennis and that she'd been assisting vice squads in setting up drug dealing busts. She said that one time she'd been followed from the Eastburn home by an angry drug dealer, but that she couldn't identify the man. On July 4, 1986, after deliberating for 12 hours, the jury came back with their verdict. They found Hennis guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of first-degree rape. He was sentenced to death on July 8th and was subsequently transferred to death row at the Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina. As his appeal was being prepared, Hennis received an anonymous letter in prison. The letter read, "Dear Mr. Hennis, I did the crime. I murdered the Eastburns. Sorry you're doing the time. I'll be safely out of North Carolina when you read this. Thanks, Mr. X." The letter was postmarked on July 8th, the day Hennis was sentenced. A copy of the letter was also sent to the sheriff's office, but it was widely believed that the letter was a hoax. In 1988, defense lawyer Gerald Beaver appealed Hennis's conviction, arguing that the overly graphic and gruesome crime scene photos and video shown to the jury had unduly influenced them against his client. The judge agreed, and Hennis was granted a retrial. In the second trial, the defense team obtained the services of private investigator Bob Nelligar to retrace the steps of investigators and look for any details that the police could have missed in the investigation. Nelligar and the defense team conducted a reenactment of the night that Patrick Cohn said he saw a man that resembled Hennis. While performing the reenactment, David Hill, a neighbor from across the street, approached them and told them that on the night of the murder, he'd approached a van parked in front of the Eastburns' home. He spoke to a white male with a crew cut who said he'd just stopped to talk with some friends whose voices David could hear coming from the back of the van. A couple days later, David saw the same van for sale in a Winn-Dixie parking lot. The defense spoke again to Patrick Cohn, whose testimony was crucial. This time when they interviewed him, however, he told them that he was questioning his recollection of what he'd seen early that morning and whether his description of the man was accurate. Aside from the witness testimony, Nelligar found that the hairs and fingerprints found at the crime scene did not match Hennis or any friend or other family member of the Eastburns. The services of forensic expert Paul Stonebough were also brought in for the trial. Stonebough went to the Eastburn residence to review the crime scene 6 months after the murders. While there, he located a condom package underneath a dresser that had obviously and shockingly not been discovered by police. Stonebough's assessment of this was that consensual sex had occurred inside the home prior to the murders, as he believed that rapists rarely carried condoms with them to commit their crimes. He also believed that through the evidence, the murders were committed by 2 individuals. Nelligar spoke with Lucille Cook, a woman who'd used her ATM card at the same time and place as Katie's card had been used, and contrary to the other witness at the ATM, she told him that she never saw anyone during her time there. The Eastburns' neighbors Chuck and Cherry Radke spoke with Nelligar and told him that they had been out walking early the morning that Patrick Cohn claimed to see the blonde man and said they never saw anyone out at that early hour. However, a few nights later, they did see a blonde man with a crew cut, wearing a black beret and a members-only jacket, and carrying a black garbage bag over his shoulder. He was walking down the street at the same time the Eastburn murders would have happened a few nights prior. The prosecution took their turn nailing down Patrick Cohn's recollection of that morning, and Van Story said that just because the hair and fingerprints at the scene didn't match Hennis, that did not mean he didn't commit the crime. Timothy Hennis's retrial began on February 27, 1989. Gerald Beaver and Billy Richardson were again the defense attorneys, and new prosecutors were representing the state, Calvin Collier and John Dixon. Van Story was not part of the retrial. The prosecution brought in a new witness, a neighbor, Elisa Peabody. Peabody testified she previously told authorities that she didn't see anyone the night of the murders, but was now adamant that she had, in fact, seen Hennis leave the scene of the crime. In their argument, the defense challenged the prosecution's witnesses and the evidence, and they focused on Cohn's criminal record. After the first trial, Cohn had been in trouble with the law and told an officer he was too valuable to lock up because he was a witness in the Hennis trial. Cohn's testimony immediately became discredited, and the defense was successful in presenting him as an unreliable witness. They also contradicted Cohn's description of the weather the night of the murders. Cohn said the weather was fair, but a meteorologist and helicopter pilot both testified that the weather had been overcast and dark, and that because of that, Cohn would have had a hard time seeing the man. Witness Lucille Cook, the female witness who saw a blonde male at the ATM, was also challenged. The defense pointing out that she'd initially told investigators she didn't see Hennis, but then changed her story after she'd seen Hennis on the news and in papers and could have picked up his face from the media. They revealed that she'd told investigators that she didn't remember anything before making sure that her version of the story was in place before the first trial. When she testified at the second trial that she remembered Hennis waiting a minute or two before leaving the ATM, the defense used dramatic reenactments of that moment and had the jury sit in silence to demonstrate the length of time between the man's transaction at the ATM and Lucille Cook's transaction. They also presented bank record timestamps to prove that Cook was lying. The defense called two new witnesses to the stand, a newspaper delivery woman who claimed she saw a long-haired man driving a light-colored van on the morning of March 11th, and a surprise witness, a teenager named John Raupach, who lived in the East Burns neighborhood, who was walking near their home the night of the murders. Private investigator T.V. O'Malley had located Raupach, who'd been seen by neighbors Chuck and Cherry Radke, and also by a newspaper deliverer, Charlotte Kirby. To the surprise of everyone in court, Raupach was a spitting image of Hennis. He was 6'4" and had also been wearing a members-only jacket, a white shirt, dark corduroy pants, and a knit cap that night. He also always carried a book bag over his shoulder. Raupach told police when he realized how similar he looked to their suspect, police took his jacket and hat and hid it from the defense, only to return it to Raupach once Hennis was in prison. The dry cleaner that cleaned the members-only jacket testified that they didn't use any special chemicals that would clean blood off of clothes. To prove this, the defense poured blood on a random jacket and cleaned it with blood-cleaning chemicals. They then tested the jacket with luminol, and even after it was clean, remnants of blood still showed. But when Hennis's members-only jacket was tested with luminol, there were no signs of blood. The burned remains from Hennis's barrel was also tested, and no additional evidence was found. In addition to the new witnesses, the defense presented footprints, blood, and hair samples from the crime scene that did not match Hennis or any of the victims. In his defense, Hennis also surprisingly took the stand. This tactic apparently worked in his favor because after 2 days of deliberation, the jury acquitted Hennis of all charges. Hennis left court with his wife and his 4-year-old daughter as a free man. Following his acquittal, Hennis assumed his life as normal and reenlisted in the United States Army to recoup back pay for the years he'd spent in prison and was promoted to the rank of staff sergeant. In 1990, he was deployed to Iraq during Operation Desert Storm and also to Somalia. During his service in the military, he received several accolades and awards. Then, in 1998, Hennis and his family moved to Lakewood, Washington, where he became a scoutmaster of his son's scout troop. In 2004, he retired from the Army as a master sergeant and became employed at a waste treatment plant. But justice has a funny way of creeping back up on you when you least expect it. In spring of 2005, Captain Larry Trotter of the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office attended a seminar on advanced criminal intelligence techniques. As part of the seminar, the Eastburn murders were displayed as a case study. After talking with journalist Scott Wisnant, who had covered the murders, Trotter found out that semen from Katie's body had been extracted using a vaginal swab and was kept in evidence. As DNA testing was still fairly new in the 1980s, that swab could now be tested with new DNA technology. Trotter had the same semen on the swab taken from the rape kit used on Katie, and it was tested at the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation's Crime Laboratory in Raleigh. And in June 2006, the test results came back, and it was determined that the sample was 1.2 quadrillion times more likely to come from Hennis. The results were shared with the Cumberland County District Attorney's Office, and Edward Grannis and Robert Biddle were notified. The attorneys quickly contacted Gary Eastburn to tell him of the news. While Hennis was living a semi-retired life in Washington, coincidentally, Gary Eastburn also lived in Washington, and unbeknownst to him, only 15 miles from Hennis. Although the Fifth Amendment's double jeopardy clause came into play, which prevented a retrial for the same crime after an acquittal, there was a loophole. Hennis could still be prosecuted through the United States Army under the dual sovereignty doctrine, which states that different sovereign states can prosecute a defendant multiple times for the same offense. The Cumberland County Sheriff's Office asked that Lieutenant General John R. Vines, the commanding officer at Fort Bragg, recall Hennis back into service so that he could be charged and tried with the Eastburn murders based on the new DNA evidence. Hennis was recalled to military duty at Fort Bragg on September 26, 2006. In August 2007, the commander of the 17th Airborne Corps ordered that Hennis be court-martialed on three counts of premeditated murder. In December of that same year, Hennis appealed that decision, claiming the Army lacked jurisdiction, but the petition was denied. From May 2008 through December 2009, he appealed to the U.S. Army Court of Criminal Appeals, to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, and to the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina, and all were dismissed. The court-martial for Timothy Hennis at Fort Bragg began on March 17, 2010, and would last for 3 weeks. Hennis's attorneys were military lawyer Frank Spinner and two additional uniformed lawyers. Army Captains Matt Scott and Nathan Huff led the prosecution team, with Colonel Patrick Parrish presiding. The prosecution presented the damning new DNA evidence and also included the previous eyewitness accounts. This time, Hennis did not testify, and neither did his wife Angela or his son Andrew. But his 25-year-old daughter Christina did testify on his behalf, stating that her father was her hero. His cousins would talk about family trips where Hennis, the oldest of the group, made sure the younger ones were always safe. Hennis's coworkers also testified, talking about his work ethic, how punctual he was, and how committed he was to Army values. The defense argued that there was no blood, no fingerprints, or fiber evidence that connected Hennis to the crime. They also stated that Hennis had been seen working on a dollhouse for his daughter at the time the bank transaction records showed Katie's stolen ATM card had been used. They also addressed the DNA testing of the semen by throwing in a new theory. They claim that Hennis and Katie had consensual sex that day, a detail that Hennis had failed to share previously because he didn't want to add to Gary Eastburn's grief. The defense played on this story, theorizing that a young wife whose husband had been away for so long could have, on impulse, decided to sleep with Hennis when he picked up the dog. They also claimed that the crime scene evidence at the Eastburn home had been contaminated.
As the military panel members walked in, some looked at Sergeant Hennis. The verdict was then handed to the judge and then handed back to the...
And on April 8, 2010, after deliberating for only 3 hours, the jury unanimously found Hennis guilty. On April 15th, 52-year-old Hennis was sentenced to death and was demoted to Private E1, stripped of all his pay and allowances, and dishonorably discharged from the United States Army.
Minutes after the verdict, Gary Eastburn had waited 20 years to hear, the man who had suffered so much had something to say to the family of the man found responsible.
My heart goes out to them. Can certainly relate to the pain you're feeling. And my heart goes out to them. And I hope none of you feel that I'm gloating over this. I'm not. I just feel like justice has finally been done.
Jana Eastburn, who doesn't remember that fateful night and doesn't have any recollection of her mother or her sisters, was in attendance at Hennis's sentencing and had this to say.
I just want them to know how it's affected my life and that how it's affected my dad's life and how I feel like I've been robbed of half of my life, half of my family. And I just want to have closure for them, really. They deserve that.
But although justice has been served and Hennis is now behind bars, Jana said there's a question that continues to linger and haunt her.
My biggest thing is why didn't he kill me? Why didn't he? I don't know. Obviously, I think I was left here from my dad.
For the next 9 years, Hennis would try every different avenue to appeal his conviction and obtain a new trial, but all efforts were denied. He's currently housed at the United States Disciplinary Barracks at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, and to this day maintains his innocence. Following the murders of his wife and two daughters, Gary Eastburn was transferred to an Air Force base just north of London and moved with his daughter Jana to England in 1988. It was there that he met a nurse named Elizabeth, who he ended up marrying in 1991. Little Jana was then 8 years old, and Elizabeth became the only mother she would ever know. When asked what he missed most about his family, Gary Eastburn replied, "Them. I miss being with them." The case of the Eastburn murders remains one of the most controversial in U.S. criminal history. Many people believe that Hennis was wrongly convicted and that the evidence against him was insufficient. Others believe Hennis is guilty and got away with murder for so long due to legal technicalities and, of course, lack of modern-day DNA testing. Despite the many twists and turns in this case, new technology is continuing to provide investigators with answers that have gone undiscovered for years or even decades. Tim Hennis is the only person who's been tried 3 times after guilty and not guilty verdicts. It's not likely that he'll be put to death due to presidential approval required for military executions, which hasn't happened since the 1960s. He's currently one of just four men on the U.S. military's death row. That does it for this episode of The Crime Shack. Thank you for listening. Please check out our website at thecrimeshack.com, where you can find links to all our social media platforms. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to us and be sure to go on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review. We love to hear from our listeners. Until next time, stay safe out there.